that the biggest mistake dentists who start up a practice make is the fact that they want to start up where they live, right? And look, that's a mistake for a number of reasons. Dentists live in similar areas, you know?
Welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm Dave, and this is part two with Dr. Nov Kashyap. As you know, Nov is really generous with what he shares, and in this podcast, we dive really deep into how he mentors graduates in his own practice, what he expects from them, and the ways he supports them. He talks a lot more about what you can expect from the practice you start at and how important that first choice is. And he also goes into some detail on startups and purchasing practices and what people need to think about down the track. Obviously, most of us are graduates and early in our career, and this isn't really where we're at right now. But I think it's important to understand a lot of this stuff because you get a better perspective on where your owner or the corporate or whoever is coming from when they make certain decisions. It was a real pleasure talking with Nov, and he shares a lot of his wisdom. I hope you enjoy this episode. So you're talking about mentorship. Did you have any other points you wanted to make on that?
I think with respect to mentoring, it can take quite a few forms. And so, you know, what the plan that we have for our graduates, as an example, and look, this is like the really, really heavy end of mentoring. It's not always going to be this involved and hands-on, and neither should you expect it to be, because, you know, in most practices that have one or two dentists and you're hired as a third associate, which is, you know, most practices out there, the level of mentoring that they offer is going to be different, and you know, it can be better in some ways. You know, our mentoring basically involves, we have a group chat with all our dentists in there. So at any time during the day, you know, this is like, I'm not sure how many dentists are in that group chat, but there's a lot. And any time during the day, someone can post up an X-ray or a clinical photo or, just a general question about anything to do with a patient they might have in the chair or just a case, and you've got input instantly from a number of dentists. And that's, you know, it's not like a big group. If you haven't got that, certainly, you know, some of the forums online can offer that. But this is a way to do it amongst a group of peers that, you know, understand the situation perhaps a bit better and can provide that support. At each clinic, you know, we always have them with a more senior dentist at least, you know, and in some clinics there's multiple dentists
on. For how long? How many years or whatever?
So generally, you know, or there's sometimes that graduates will have a day where they don't have a dentist on. Usually that's not a rostered day. That's more a day where, like, you know, if a dentist is away, they have to just be by themselves. So it's not like they're never by themselves, but rostered days, working independently, can start in their second year. Yep. In the first year, we generally don't roster them at any clinic by themselves. And I think that's the minimum expectation for a job. You know, to have to work alongside greater than, you know, you know, like only have one day out of 5 days where you're alone, maybe that's fine. But try to not take up a job where you're just the solo dentist. That's going to really stunt your growth.
I would agree with that as a, you know, not 100% of your time on your own. I think I worked one or two solo days, but still had the, you know, I could reach out to other dentists in the area. So, you know, yes. But it wasn't like I was, you know, hundreds of kilometers away. So I think that's important, but yeah, my experience was a couple of days, as well. So yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Look, No. And look, there are graduates even that we hire that can work very independently, you know? So, for them, it's not a big thing. Like they can, you know, two or three days even, and you know, we have that. It's just generally, you know,
it's a good goal for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think, yeah, that, you know, those two modes of mentoring. And then on top of that, we have our dentists. We ask them early on what they're interested in, the graduates, you know, have you got a special interest? So my group is built on dentists with special interests. So a lot of them all do general dentistry, and then they have a special interest, where it's endo, cosmetics, you know, wisdom teeth surgery, implants, whatever it is. And then we have some specialist support behind that. So the graduates are able to go and ask their question for whatever case they have to a dentist that does this, has been to numerous courses about it, and in this one area. So, you know, whether it's peds, whether it's cosmetic. They can take a case and go to the dentist with that level of experience and be able to present that case to them and ask them their opinions, but also all of my dentists, because I've helped them at various times and because we hire really nice people, I guess, they're more than happy to mentor the grad. So when the grad has a day off, so they have 2 days off during the week, and if one of the experienced dentists has a case running on that day off, or even, you know, if they're working at the same practice at that dentist on a day on, we allow them just to close their books off for 3 hours and go and watch the veneer preps getting done. And they're fully paid for that 3 hours as well. So, you know, they're essentially paid for learning. So surgery is getting $0 coming through, but our dentist is getting upskilled, and we see that as an investment. You know, having a practice that can offer expertise in the areas that you're interested in is really, really important. And one of the reasons I'm able to attract so many people that want to work for us is because so many people are getting interested in wisdom teeth surgery. And, you know, and I've been very vocal about the type of cases that we do and the rest of that. So that's been great. The third type of mentoring is actually either watching cases or getting direct advice on cases. And then we take it a step further. So with wisdom teeth, as an example, you know, this happens for other procedures. You can book your procedure in on a day that one of those experienced dentists is on and working, and have the security of knowing that they're right next door to step in to actually help with that procedure. And in some cases, if they're not booked and you know, you've been great to them and they're happy to, they will even come in on one of their days off to watch you do a procedure.
Yeah, that's massive.
And so, you know, all of this type of mentoring is really good. We had a formal program for grads, which we got rid of. That didn't get very positive feedback, in the sense that, you know, we required them to do a case report and stuff, and you know, minimum amounts of cases during a period of time, and you know, so they have to drill some model teeth, they have to do some on patients, they have to do all of this, and it was much more formalized. You know, we thought it might be a good idea, but the feedback wasn't great from that, in the sense that when most people graduate and get to work, they don't want to be shackled by the shackles of uni anymore, you know. And so where we thought we were actually delivering them value, it wasn't the case at all. We were actually, you know, it was quite annoying to them. So we scrapped that after just a year. It's not as formal as that. But the other thing that we do is every 2 to 4 weeks, we get all the grads around and we sit down and go through their cases and questions that they have. So there's myself and one or two other dentists in the group with all our grads. And it's just the time for all of us to, yeah, get into the nitty-gritty of cases, give them general advice, give them advice on billing procedures, on any aspect of dentistry and working at our clinics that they need help on. And that's in person, a meeting every, you know, 2 to 4 weeks. So that's the other thing. And the other thing that we've got as a group now is we're getting specialists to come to talk to us. So all the specialists that we refer, you know, we put on, we're just starting that this year. We're putting on, we've always had the education side of things, where guys like Mark Hassad and others come up and talk. But now we've made that into a regular thing, where specialists will come and give a 1 or 2 hour talk on a certain topic. We'll put on some drinks and food. We'll have a mingle with all the dentists, you know, a socialization aspect to it. And some free CPD and you know, guidance on specific areas. So that's another thing that we as a larger group are sort of able to offer. And again, you know, that's not necessarily something that you'll be able to get it at a smaller practice. But then again, you can always just go to a lot of specialists around the place, hold these nights themselves, where they invite their referring dentists to. So it's not like you're missing out on something like that if you're to our dentists. You know, we're aiming to do this every 4 to 6 weeks. More like 6 to 8 weeks. We'll get someone come and speak. We'll put on some food and drink for all our dentists. It's not just the graduates. They're able to then really enjoy themselves, socialize with the other dentists in the group, but also get some free CPD and learning and, you know, discussion going on there. And I was just saying that, you know, if the practice you work at, you know, is not large enough to be able to offer something like that, plenty of the specialists out there offer this, you know. So
yeah, I agree.
I think it's really, really good to be able to just even go to their CPD nights. Yeah,
absolutely. As I said, I'm in a smaller group, and we have had some situations where, as a group, we try to learn about this or that. Not as often as you, by the sounds of it. But the other thing is, the local specialists have put things on as well, and that's been really cool. So learn a few things from the local endodontists. And it's definitely helped, particularly for new graduates. that was really helpful. Let's change tack again. You're known for multiple practice ownership. So how many practices is in the group at the moment?
So we're up to 6 practices at the moment. I've had a lot more than that. We sold off a lot of our Gold Coast branch of practices.
Oh, yeah.
But we, you know, when I get to around the 8 mark, that's when I have to look at a layer of corporate overhead that I don't want, you know, for a number of reasons. Number one, the cost that essentially destroys the profit of one of the surgeries and one of the medium-sized surgeries. So, you know, you might as well have 7 or 6 without that corporate layer of overhead instead of 8 with it. And this is why, you know, if you look at the financial figures of some of the corps, it's terrible because of, you know, the wastage in head office. But the other thing is, one of the things that Chris and I, my wife and I, pride ourselves on is the fact that our business is run like a family. You know, if you talk to our staff, it is a work family. You know, our staff, when they have a social event on in their personal lives, some of the first people invited are other staff. You know, that's staff that are friends with the people they work with. And that's not just the auxiliary staff separate to the dentist. This is, you know, all of us together. So I think losing that by going down the corporate thing is something that I definitely don't want while I own the businesses. I want to be able to have that.
Much harder to control culture if you're in a much, much bigger practice, too many people for everyone to even know. And I guess before you were a bit more like that, would you say, when you had, didn't you have about 14 or something?
Well, I've never owned 14 at once. Okay. I think the most is 8 or 9, 10 sort of at once. And, you know, the other thing that I said was important to us is lifestyle. And you don't have lifestyle unless you put in that corporate layer of overhead. You know, you're just wasting too much time on putting out too many fires instead of having other people do it for you. And so I think that's really important that we, you know, are able to, you know, maintain that level of, you know, the family feel that we have to our practices.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned corporate, like, you know, yourself, if you got bigger than, say, 8, you'd need a corporate layer. And then we've got obviously many corporates in Australia at the moment. What's your view on corporates at the moment?
Look, it's interesting. I think, you know, one prediction that I'll make straight up is I think the corporates will get together and push the powers to be to reopen the overseas pathway for dentists very soon. And you know, I think there's some talk of them looking at doing it already. And so basically what they'll do is they'll lobby the labor markets, the labor department and push the labor department. They'll show them that they're having difficulty hiring and push them to get the immigration department to reopen the pathway for overseas dentists. You know, honestly, that's a prediction. Within the next 2 years, I think we'll either see something. And the problem is we won't all necessarily see their lobbying. I just know that they're not having an easy time of it hiring graduates, especially because the corporates own a lot of practice. Not graduates, sorry, dentists own a lot of practices in rural areas. Yeah. And so, you know, those rural areas, if you look at dentistry, were staffed by overseas ADC grads. You know, they'd come to Australia, they'd easily get jobs in rural areas, and that's where they'd work for 5 or 6 years. Some of them might end up buying the practice or setting up there, or some of them might move back to the city. But people that live in metro Australia, you know, if they go and work rural, it's literally just for 2 years to get some great experience and then build up a base and then come back to the city. There's not many that don't grow up in rural that are willing to work there long term. You know, it's very, very seldom happens. So
it's an interesting prediction, and it does make sense too. So that model is definitely around for the long term. Do you think a job in corporate is good for a graduate?
Look, I think it's not bad. A corporate-owned practice will offer a better experience for most graduates than the average private practice. You know, and look, that'll be controversial. I'll get absolutely slaughtered for that. But I feel like I say that with some authority, knowing the way that corporates work. You know, and I am very similar to corporates in a lot of ways. If you look at everything that I said that we do for mentoring for our groups, how many average practices, when I say the average practice, I don't mean average in the bad sense of the word, I mean average in the middling sense of the word, how many of those can offer what we can offer? And the corporates can do that at a really supercharged level if they want to. So,
well, corporates and groups are forced to systemize. And if you're systemizing the onboarding process, then you've thought about it. I think a lot of average practices, exactly right. You know, just the maybe one or two chairs and then you come on as a grad, it may be really good experience, but it's not a planned, thought out mentorship program usually. Or that's obviously my opinion. I haven't done that. Small group, I guess. I've had one experience, not more than one.
And I think, you know, with the grads, like I hear about the caliber of dentists that they get to come in and specialists to train their graduates in different areas. You know, 1300 Smiles under, not 1300 Smiles, Chris Hart at, you know, Lifetime Smiles, he sold to NDC and you know, he told me they were looking at acquiring our practices, you know, a couple of years ago. We didn't go down that path, but when I spoke to him, you know, he implemented a grad program back at a time when, you know, no one was doing it. This was, you know, going back 10 or 15 years ago, and they did really well. Like, you know, we're able to get some of the best grads, we're able to give them really, really good training. And so I think corporates have hung on to that. And you know, certainly the corporates that are suffering to now hire experienced dentists are going a bit overboard with grads, because they're having to hire grads to fill in places where, you know, at times you won't have the support and mentoring. So be really careful of that in a graduate job. If you're at a smaller corporate-owned practice, then unfortunately some of the practice principals there are not incentivized to mentor you, because A, it wastes their time, they get nothing for it, and B, they're building up competition within their own practice by imparting skills on you. And unfortunately, some dentists will see that as an impact on their livelihood. So, you know, be careful of that. The difference between a privately owned practice is, and look, you know, there's plenty of privately owned practices not like this, but the difference between it is any time the owner dedicates to you, they're seeing hopefully as an investment in you within their practice. And yeah. So they're incentivized to, you know, give you the skills and the mentoring that you need. There's lots of owners, private owners out there that don't look at it like that. They see you as someone who's just there to do the cleans and the post-ops and all the stuff they don't want to do. But yeah, so, you know, watch out for that in a corporate job, that, you know, you're around dentists who aren't happy to mentor on a day-to-day basis. That's probably, you know, the main things I can think of about corporates. There's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of rhetoric about corporates putting unnecessary billing pressures on. If you look at the forums, if you talk to people that actually work for corporates, there's not really any corporate in Australia that's doing that at all. The only people that have billing pressures are the people that have sold to the corporates that need to meet certain EBITDA targets. But just your normal dentist in a corporate practice, I'm just not hearing of any pressures like that.
Yeah, I think when you do hear that kind of pressure, it's usually, well, it seems to me from what I've heard, is it's more a small practice where they've just got the wrong attitude with why they hired a graduate and then wrong expectations.
Exactly.
So it's a bit different.
Definitely.
So do you think practice ownership is for everyone?
Look, definitely not. I think the one that comes to mind that it's definitely not for is the person who is a micromanager of everything, who cannot delegate anything that they're responsible for. I think that's one type of person that it's not for. The other type of person that it's not for, so one of the reasons, just going back a step, that people get into practice ownership is autonomy. One of the main reasons they get into it. So it's not earnings, it's autonomy, right? And how it actually happens, how that plays out in a real sense, in real life, is that you start working for someone and you want to order in certain materials, you want to use certain good materials, good equipment at a minimum level. You know, you're not being fussy, you just want good stuff. And you're not able to. You've got some ideas of how the practice should run, you know, that could make your books busier, and they're not implemented. You want to take some leave at certain times and you're not given the flexibility. You know, you're earning a ton of money, but you've got nothing to do with it. Nothing, you know, to use that money for, because you're just constrained. And so all of these things, you know, you decide you want to leave that job, you get offered another job because, you know, maybe it'll be better there. You go there and the second experience is much the same as the first. And that's when that particular type of dentist starts to think about ownership, because they're like, well, stuff this. If I'm working with someone else, this is just going to keep happening. I need to just get a job for myself. So, you know, I run a lot of seminars on training people on how to become owners. And one of the main reasons people want to be owners that attend my seminars is this autonomy factor. But unfortunately, they've usually got a sample size that's too small to make that decision that every practice is like that, because it's not, A. And B, I think that that when they get into ownership for that reason, yes, they get the autonomy, but they give that autonomy up almost overnight. And I'll tell you why. Number one, when you're an owner, you look at things a lot differently. You look at supplies and materials not as what's perfect to be used in your hands. It's more what is the material that I can use that delivers the best possible result at the cheapest possible price, right?
Another side of thinking about
and
it.
And so, exactly right. Once you start thinking about it, then you evolve, right? When you're a graduate and you wanted to use, or when you're an associate, sorry, and you wanted to use this certain composite because it handled well and it was triple the price of the composite that the practice was ordering, but, you know, I can do a much better job and it handles better, it's a better composite. When clinical studies don't prove any of that, like in terms of a longevity sense, when you get into your own practice and the rep comes in with a cheaper composite and tells you, you know, the one you're currently using, this will cost you half as much. And the amount that you order, it's going to give you X amount of savings, right? Let's say that conversation happens with a rep. Yeah. When you're an associate, you don't care about that because you're not paying for the composite, right? When you're an owner, that starts to matter. So, you know, and that this happens in all situations, right? Now, all of a sudden, you know, you were asking your previous owner for time off every 6 weeks to have a weekend away with your spouse. Now, all of a sudden, that weekend away not only costs you money when you've got bills to pay and repayments to make on the practice loans, but also that's time you're not going to be seeing any patients. So all of a sudden, that autonomy gets taken away from you, right? So when owners get into ownership for the sole reason of autonomy, when they don't enjoy owning a business, that is a real problem. Because what ends up happening, and you see this so much on the owners group, is dentists that are owners that are great clinicians but absolutely hate the running of the practice. And these are the types that will sell to the corporates, because, you know, they can still have some of that autonomy. They can still have all that. They don't have any of the business headache. You know, these dentists don't want to know about marketing. You know, they don't want to know about payroll. They don't want to know about, I mean, obviously they want to pay their staff, but they're not interested in doing any of that themselves. And especially they hate HR and confrontation and managing staff. That was all taken care of them. And they never saw the positives in their associateship. They never saw the stuff they didn't have to do.
It's huge.
Then all of a sudden, yeah, exactly. So look, you know, practice ownership, if you're looking to embark on practice ownership, and I know I haven't answered your question completely and directly in if it's for everyone, but what you should look at doing firstly is really closely examine your reasons for ownership. Why is it that you want ownership, right? And once you've got those reasons down pat and then a self-examination of your views towards delegation and micromanaging, once you've got that stuff down pat, then look at, you know, consider ownership. Start to look at it.
That makes a lot of sense.
The big difference between ownership now and 10, 15 years ago is you could make massive mistakes with your location selection and just choose any area. Like, you know, you could put a map up of Australia, throw a dart, hit anywhere, and you'll basically do well. That's not the case anymore. You know, we're starting to see a lot more dental bankruptcies. We're starting to see a lot more practices under stress and closing down. But more than that, you know, we talked at the very start about this profession and you know, the earnings and the lifestyle that affords us. There's an opportunity cost for that, right? So you could go work for someone else, or you could own your own practice and only bill $300,000-$400,000 a year at that practice. And sure, you know, you're your own boss, But by the time you don't even get 40%, because by the time you get your 40%, you have to put that back in to pay some of the business bills because you're not profitable from a business sense of the word. And all of a sudden, instead of, you know, being able to bill $500,000 and pocket $200,000, you're billing $500,000 and only pocketing $120,000, right? Yes, you've got your own business, but through the prime years, your opportunity cost of $80,000 a year is freaking huge, yeah. You know, like over 10 years, that's just under $1 million.
Absolutely.
And
that's
so,
5 years of retirement.
exactly right. And so you need to really, really consider that. You know, we've got an associate that works in our group that's, that, you know, I probably shouldn't go into that in too much detail, but basically, you know, they had their own practice and the difference in what they were earning with us and their own practice was huge. And, what they didn't realize, because they were reasonably comfortable, was the opportunity cost of those days that they worked in their own practice was massive. You know, it was up to $1,000 to $2,000 a day for that experienced graduate. And so, you know, 2-3 days a week, you can do the numbers on that. So yeah, look, bear that in mind. It's a challenging environment for ownership out there. I would say that success as an owner was an inevitability 10 to 15 years ago, you know, or as close to an inevitability as you can get. It's certainly not that way now.
That's a really good point. I've got so much I want to ask about that. But the first one is on the Dental Head Start group, there was another question. It was how does it compare opening your own practice now versus say 10, 15 years ago? Obviously you've said, you know, you could have made some big mistakes 10, 15 years ago and possibly still been all right. Do you want to elaborate a little bit more on those differences with corporates, your profitability and competition?
Yeah, definitely. Look, let me start off by saying that the biggest mistake dentists who start up a practice make is the fact that they want to start up where they live, right? And look, that's a mistake for a number of reasons. Dentists live in similar areas, you know, and that's because we have not just similar interests, but we have similar earning capacity. We have, you know, we're at the upper end of society in terms of earnings, and therefore we're at the upper end of society in terms of the suburbs and stuff we choose to live in or are able to live in. And as a result of that, if you think you want to work close to home, well, look, there's 100 other dentists that have already thought of that, right? Because they all want to work close to home too. And so, you know, you go to your local shops every week and do your grocery shopping, and all of a sudden a for lease sign becomes available. And that's as far, that's as much research as you do about whether this is a good spot to start a practice or not. And, you know, that's literally just the availability of commercial premises to put your dental practice into. Mm. And this happens time and again. And, you know, you can grind out something and, you know, 5 years, you can be profitable from a business sense. You can have this great base of patients. But you've lost a lot in that 5 years. And you know, your growth is capped. You're kind of like, the other thing about those desirable areas, those inner areas, is that competition will keep coming. You know, I started a practice in a suburb up here in Queensland where we were in that practice. We were in that suburb. We were the third practice. The other two had pretty much closed off their books. One had definitely closed off their books to patients, new patients. Within 2 years of opening that practice, six practices opened within an 8-kilometer radius of that practice.
Wow. What years were they? Like, has there been a spike when all this has happened?
2012, 2013. Okay. Look, the number of practices opening has definitely slowed down because of the lack of ADC graduates coming in now. And also, two things have caused that. Now, lack of ADC graduates, because a lot of these people were owners in their own countries. They came here, they needed to work for someone, for a year and a half, 2 years, and then they were ready to go and get into their own practice again. So, you know, that caused a huge spike. But also what's caused that stopping is stopping that pathway, but more and more people are hearing about dentists running into trouble. Whereas 5-6 years ago, it was really rare for a dental surgery to run into trouble. Now there's a lot more optics around all the practices that do. You know, the lenders have become
tired. I was going to ask that as well. You said before there's been more dental bankruptcy in recent years, which is pretty much unheard of in the past. I thought it was like 98% or something success with lending. Does that mean lending rates are going to go up and other changes in that, the financial sphere?
Yeah, look, I haven't seen a massive change in rates. Sorry, at least I haven't seen a massive change in the rate discount that we get relative to other professions or other business types. But what I do see definitely is a lot more scrutiny by the lenders. You know, the amounts that they're lending are significantly less. You don't have an open checkbook anymore. Yeah. And if it's a startup, you really have to justify the location, or you have to justify a business plan at least. And they're scrutinizing the borrower a lot more, both from a clinical perspective, like how experienced they are, as well as a financial perspective, like, you know, what their financial backing is, what equity they have, all that type of stuff. You know, it's just basically getting a lot harder to get loans. So I know we've veered off topic a little bit, but in terms of you know, your original question with regards to, you know, the success and you know, some of the challenges for practice ownership, I think, you know, the biggest mistake that people make is that in choosing their location, you know, they need to be aware that you don't just start a practice where you live. And so I think that's really important. What was the other question that you mentioned, sorry, David, in regards to what you got on the group with relation to this?
The specific question was competition, profits and corporates and how it's changed in the last 15 years.
Yeah. So in terms of competition and that, you know, I sort of touched on that. You need to be looking outside, you know, within 45 minutes of any Eastern Seaboard CBD is probably not a good place for a startup. If you're an experienced dentist, or sorry, you're not an experienced dentist, we're dealing with graduates here, but if you're, you know, 2-3 years out and you're billing at a really good rate, you know, let's say you're billing that $700,000-$800,000 a year, you really need to question whether starting a practice is for you. You know, if you want ownership, you really need to look at buying an existing practice, because you're leaving a lot on the table in terms of lost earnings,
productivity time, opportunity cost.
Exactly,
when you're starting.
Right.
That's the next question: is startup versus purchase, and when would you think about either one? I know you love startups and you teach startups, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, you know, I teach startup and buying. In my last two practices that just settled in February, like this month, have been purchases. And I won't be starting any practices anytime soon, because, you know, I've those locations that were really good to be able to meet that amount of profitability that I needed are just not there anymore. You know, they're becoming harder and harder and harder. You know, purchasing good practices is the way to go for me. If I want to stay within close by, you know, if I don't want to go rural, if you want to go rural and regional, startups are certainly still an option. But you know, if you're not bringing a significant patient base, which in most cases you really shouldn't be stealing off your previous owner, then starting up is probably not the way to go.
So there's been significant changes in recent years that have changed your opinion on that, would you say?
Definitely, definitely. And even the way that our course has evolved, you know, the buying component was a lot smaller in our course, and it's a big part of our course now. Look, and that's not to say that there isn't still startup spots available, but they're usually those fringe suburbs that where, you know, you can stand in the shops and look out and you can see like hundreds of houses being built and big subdivisions, you know. So those out of fringe growth areas, and sometimes they are within 45 minutes of the CBD, you know, but they're the places that you need to look at. You know, Melbourne's got a lot of that happening right now. Brisbane's got it. I know Sydney's got it as well. So there are those growth and fringe areas. But look, just be aware of the biggest tip for that if you do a startup is to be aware of your position within that suburb once it's built out. Right. And so you've got to weigh that against being the first dentist into that suburb versus how that suburb's going to grow and where that's going to leave your practice from an exposure point of view and an accessibility point of view for patients in the long term. Okay. So just be really careful of that.
Don't look at the first 2 years where you're right next to that first opening area, but then the rest of it's too far away or something like that.
100%. You just summed it up really well. Yeah. But look, startup versus thing. There's still a lot of nuance to it, and there's no right answer. But I can confidently say, if you're a dentist doing over 700,000-800,000 in billings, your first port of call should be buying an existing practice.
Yeah, that's good advice. I hadn't thought about it that way. That makes a lot of sense. I want to get an idea. Let's talk a little bit about the numbers. So someone might be listening to this thinking, oh, one day I want to do a purchase or a startup or something. What kind of ballpark figures are we looking at? For instance, a startup versus purchasing a practice with a $700,000 turnover?
Excellent question. So look, that's That's a really good question. In terms of a startup, my advice would be to not spend anywhere over $500,000 on a startup. That's equipment, fit out, all your costs. If you should be able to do it closer to the $400,000. You know, I've had practices where I've started them for $250,000, but I get access to discounts that many people won't be getting necessarily just because of the volume that we do. Six years ago, I could say $300 to $350. Everyone could do a really good practice within that. You know, one chair, modularize the fit out so you don't do the whole thing. You look at that now; it's probably closer to $400 to $450. But certainly, don't go anywhere over $500,000 if it's a startup.
And that's per single chair or two chairs?
That's a single chair practice. Two chairs might be closer to the $500. And certainly, you know, if you can get a good deal on your fit out and good deal on the chairs, I recommend sticking to the bigger brands, because don't go for the cheap stuff that's coming from overseas at the moment. All the chairs come from overseas, but the cheap stuff out of China, for example, is just really dodgy. Yeah. Stick to the reputable brands, because, you know, once your chair breaks down, your lost earnings make up for any difference in saving at the front end. That's rough budgeting figures for startups. In terms of buying a practice, though, that's a lot harder to answer. So, we do a 2-hour lecture on everything you need to look for buying a practice and the value of the practice. And then we actually do exercises where we've got two practices that were for sale, where you look at those practices and you examine them and you come at a figure, and in the room the groups that we have, there's variability of 100% of the actual price across what people think that a practice should be worth. So what I'm getting at with that, it's not a plug of my course, but what I'm getting at is that valuing practices is very, very difficult. And what's important to you as an owner, like there's a practice for sale near a good friend of mine right now, the right thing for him to do is pay 50% more than anyone else will pay for that practice, because strategically it's close to his other practices and it just takes out a competitor as well as allows him a real monopoly in that area. For him, it makes sense. Now, for someone who's graduated and got some skills as far as orthodontics go, you know, they've gone and done some training. For that person to pay a little more for a practice that's not far from where they live, that's got a huge amount of untapped ortho, where there's no visiting orthodontists in the area, where not many of the other general dentists are doing ortho, and where there's a population that really needs orthodontics, or there's lots in the population that he could or she could see, I think that type of practice, that person should pay a little bit more for than someone who has absolutely no orthodontic skills. These are just examples. Yeah. So what I'm getting at is purchase price is not necessarily just dictated by the market. It's also dictated by your clinical width and breadth. And so I think that's important for people to consider. But to answer your question a bit more directly.
Can you give us just a ballpark, just so we get an idea? Because I literally have no idea.
A practice that's doing $700,000, that's a dual preferred provider for health funds, like Medibank and Bupa, preferred provider, will sell close to that $700,000 mark. In some instances, it will sell for more. A practice without preferred provider, and that's been open, let's say, 2 years, will sell for a little bit more. That's doing $700,000. Will sell a little bit more for a practice that's open 15 years and doing $700,000. But you're probably looking at around anywhere between $350 to $500. $550 for a practice that's doing $700 with no preferred providers. Yeah. And certainly you'd be on the top range, upper end of that range, if it's a practice that's recently opened, because, you know, it's got a growth trajectory that the established practice, the older practice, doesn't have.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, there's so much that goes into that. Do you have any other advice for when people are thinking about that kind of stuff? Like, one of the things that comes to my mind is a clinician that's been there a long time that really loves it, good with their patients, but then also may have left a lot of dentistry on the table, as in work that hasn't, you know, lots of patching, for instance.
Yeah. And so, look, there's a double-edged sword to that. We've just bought a practice very similar to that. And the problem with practices like that is that patient base is not necessarily used to the young dentist coming in and offering them crowns for, you know, the teeth that need crowns, and you can offend the patients and really scare them off. But if there's a lot left on the table clinically, I'm not so much looking at it from the sense that you're offering different dentistry to the previous owner on the patients that, you know, on the dentistry they've already been doing. So, you know, doing crowns instead of fillings, that's not so much the area that you want to look at. It's more the services that are not being offered at all, you know, implants and wisdom teeth surgery and orthodontics, for an example, or root canal treatments, you know, the treatments that were being referred out. That's the source of growth clinically, but that's not even the biggest thing that you should be looking at. It should really be the overall potential. So, you know, the opening hours, for example, if you're willing to work till 8 o'clock and it's a working class area and everyone wants after hours appointments, you know, the guy that just sold his practice to us said to us, you know, oh, you're going to do so well if you're going to open till 8 o'clock. Yet he never opened till 8 o'clock because he just didn't want to. You know, he was approaching the twilight of his career. It's an area where those 4 till 8 appointment slots will book up before any time he had available. You know, he didn't open weekends. You know, that's easy growth that's on the table. You know, instead of trying to find the clinical aspects that you can grow on, these overall aspects are just a lot easier. He doesn't have a website. He wasn't advertising at all, like $0 on advertising. You know, and for a startup, I recommend between $30,000 to $40,000 of marketing spend. And so, you know, all of that, when you look at all of that, that's more the stuff that you should look at when you're looking at value. And that's where I think if you're looking at a practice, you need to be able to identify value. Those are two really good examples. There's a lot of examples off the items fee report and the rest of that. We cover that in a lot of depth when we're trying to teach our, you know, attendees about how they should look at practices. But we also offer a service for that. So if you've got, you know, a practice in mind and that, definitely get in contact. But in terms of the tips that I can offer in relation to that, what you're looking to do essentially when you're purchasing a practice is to find value either through your accountant, and that's a really good point as well, getting a good commercial accountant. Your accountant, I've seen an accountant like the one that we use, is able to find value for their clients in a P&L that the actual seller's accountant has not even been able to identify. So essentially what they've done is the seller's accountant has basically left money on the table for their client by presenting an EBITDA statement that has a lower profit than what is actually being made because they're not seeing the proper ad backs that they should, the stuff that shouldn't be in the P&L. They've come at a lower EBITDA figure than what our accountant does. And our accountant's, you know, just basically said to the client that, look, you should really buy this practice because there's this much more EBITDA that they're not actually seeing just through their examination. So what you're essentially doing, just going back to my point, was you're looking to buy a practice where you can see value, right? Some people, that's not what they want. They just want a practice near their house that they can go in, just do the same numbers as the practice was doing, but have a job close to home, have autonomy, the rest of that. Look, if that's your reason, you don't necessarily have to eke out that value if you're comfortable with no growth and the fact that the profitability will stay the same. But there's also overstaffing, you know, in a practice that you're buying that's, and you see this with older guys, you know, these older dentists that have been established for 30 years, getting to the end of their career. They've got nurses in the practice that just come in and it's literally just an act of socializing. They come in and they all just have a good yarn all day. There's three of them in there. They've got one chair open. They're all on $35 an hour. And you know, the dentist has made his money. He's happy with his $150,000 a year because he's got, you know, $6 million, $10 million worth of assets and money in super because he's been working for so long and made the right investments. And yeah, he doesn't really care. When you come in, there's a lot to be said about just running that practice a lot more efficiently. So finding value in that way, I think, is really important. It can really help you pay off your loans faster. It can land you in a very good financial position very, very quickly.
So you can look for things that allow you to bill more, I guess, or grow more, but also then on the other end, you want to save more in what you spend in the business. And both of them you can see before you even purchase a practice.
Exactly right.
So I've got another question from someone on the group, and they said they're looking at buying, by the sounds of it, a share of a practice. So what are the things to be aware of if you're buying a small share of a practice that you're working at, say 25%?
Yeah, look, I don't really encourage buying of smaller shares in practices where someone else in the practice has a bigger share than you do. So, you know, four equal partners of 25% is a lot different to being in partnership with someone that owns 75%. So the four equal of 25, if they're not related, you know, they're independent people, is not too bad. The big thing you've got to keep in mind, though, is age differences between the partners, okay? So if your exit strategy is not in sync, I've seen this happen numerous times where someone gets screwed, and you don't want to be the person getting screwed. So what I mean by that is, like, if you've got a big practice and, you know, two partners are going to retire at the same time, and their value of the practice is 50% and it's huge, and you're never going to get funded for that. Buying in at 25% when they're approaching retirement can be an issue. It can also be a positive, right? So if you can't afford it and no one wants to buy a minor share, then they're forced to sell at a lower price if they really want to sell it. And some people get to the end of their career and they really want to sell it. You know, there's a situation right now of a practice that I know for sale where, you know, two of the partners bought out a partner not long ago and they're going to be, you know, selling their share and for a lot more, because what happens is the value of that 25% is a lot less than 25% of selling the whole practice. So you've got to keep that in mind when you're buying minority shares, that the goodwill component of your share is valued a lot less, because there's seriously just no market. There's no external market, for a 25% share in a practice. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, so only a dentist would buy it, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying only a dentist that works in the practice would buy. So, you know, like, I wouldn't go and buy a 25% share and go into business with three partners in a practice I knew nothing about, and not many people do. But if one of the, you know, up-and-coming associates wants your partnership, yes, you'll find good value for it and you might be able to get a good price. But if that doesn't sync up, then you're in a lot of trouble with, you know, getting what you think it's worth. The other thing to bear in mind is being in partnership is a risk, and we discuss that risk in a lot of detail as well. There's lots of elements of risk. So my view on partnership is, don't just go into partnership for the sake of it. You know, some people go into partnership because they're mates with someone at uni and they got along really well, and you know, they want to be partners. You know, we've just bought a practice that just settled in, you know, the different one, not the one I just talked about. We settled two, where, you know, these guys went to uni together. They were really good friends. They ran a great business together for 5 years, and now they don't even talk to each other, or are very close to not talking to each other. And so partnership is always a risk, no matter how close you are to that person. So to go into it, there's got to be a reason. You can't just, don't just go into it for the sake of, you know, the security of having a partner and it just feels good to be in business with your mate. You know, don't do it for those reasons.
Yeah, I've heard, I think it's Howard Foran. He says it's like marrying a dentist but not having sex.
Yeah.
So a further question to that was in relation to the purchase price, and you partially answered it, I think. Is it calculated in the way that's similar to buying the whole practice? And I guess you're going to say it's less value.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot less. So it's, you know, when we value a practice, we will value it. If it's a half share, you know, sometimes it's very close. But if it's like a minority share like you just spoke about, it's going to be nowhere near the value. Because the other thing is, those practices that are bigger, that have multiple shareholders, when they've got multiple shareholders, they're harder to sell to a corporate as well, because you need all four partners to agree to sell at the same time, right? And if they don't all agree to sell at the same time, then you're left in a situation where, unfortunately, you know, you may miss out on this really good corporate figure that the corporate's offering, because not everyone wants to sell. And then you're left with, offers from the external market of dentists and or the associate they can't afford as much. So, you know, just, bear that in mind for minority shares. The valuation is certainly not on par with that percentage of if you were to sell the whole practice at once.
So lots to think about. Definitely a slightly riskier thing to consider.
Yeah.
So let's wrap it up. We've taken a lot of your time. We really appreciate that, Nov. I want to ask you a couple, just they're pretty general questions. We partially covered them. I always think, if you could think back to dental school or your first couple of years, and for you personally, give yourself some advice, what would that have been?
I think in terms of the early years of practice ownership, would have been to get educated on HR a lot sooner than I did. You know, we've fixed our HR strategy and our culture and our practices, I can, you know, hand on heart say, is excellent. You know, the staff that we have enjoy working for us. They enjoy working with each other, but that's taken a lot longer to build than it should have. So that's probably the biggest business piece of advice I'd give to myself, if I could go back in time. There's other stuff that I would tell myself in regards to, you know, I was quite aggressive in starting practices. And that was great, but I could have been even more aggressive than that. If I look at some of the practices that I didn't start in areas that other people did and how successful they've been now, that was a gold rush. Yeah. You know, like dentistry in the early 2010 period, 2008 to about 2013, 14 was phenomenal for, those practices. Some of those are multi-million dollar practices now that were started back then. Early days of my career. The advice that I gave at the start is really sound advice. I didn't make a lot of mistakes early on in my career, not because of anything other than the fact that I just got really lucky. You know, like the decisions I made were just a fluke at the time. They've retrospectively been identified as being great decisions, but at the time I didn't go into it thinking they were very good decisions. So all the tips I gave in terms of finding your first job and all of that I think is really important. To add to that is the two major things that I want to talk about that I haven't mentioned is one, the group of people you surround yourself with. So one thing that I've noticed with dentistry, especially dentistry nowadays, is that it is not as closed as you think it would be. So, I have people that reach out for me with questions and I dedicate time for them. These are people I've never met, never known. And there's plenty of dentists like that, you know, just contacting the guys that are active on forums that are practice owners, experienced, or just clinicians in the area that you're interested in and asking them general questions, not taking up too much of their time, but just asking them for support, even reaching out to nearby colleagues to even watch them clinically. I've had dentists come in and watch me do wisdom teeth surgery that are not even part of our group. I think there's a good support network there due to these forums, and you'd be surprised at how giving these dentists are, because a lot of them are quite successful now, but they realize that the reason that their success has come about partially has because they're standing on the shoulders of others that have built up a lot in our profession. So, plenty of the advice that I got was free business advice from friends, parents who are in business, from just mentors that I reached out to. And so, when I look at that now and a young dentist is reaching out to me, I don't necessarily see that young dentist as different to myself, because that was me, 10 years ago. And I got my questions answered back then that's allowed me to get where I am. So, it'd be pretty poor of me to not be giving back. And, like when you asked me to do the podcast, I jumped at that opportunity. I was really, really happy for the opportunity to be able to, get on here and have a chat. And I think the second thing other than that is also to get some education outside of dentistry and have a hobby. Have something that you're interested in that will keep you sane. Now, unfortunately, one of the worst parts of our career and our profession is the mental health issues that we face. And a lot of that manifests itself from day one. Even as a dental student, we had someone in our year that apparently tried to commit suicide, in dentistry while we were studying. And I know of four or five dentists that have that are no longer with us because of mental health issues. And so I think it's really important to have be grounded outside of the profession. I don't know why. I've not been able to answer why dentistry causes so many mental health issues, the profession. Because the way that I see it, we don't let our dentists do ridiculous hours. They have 2-3 days off a week. They need to have a life outside of dentistry. And I think that's great for them while they are working as well. You're just a better dentist when your headspace is better. And so, not taking this profession too seriously and devoting everything you have to it, I think is something that's important, because for whatever reason, it just is not conducive to good mental health for a lot of people, unfortunately. Yeah. So, yeah, I think.
Absolutely. That's so important. I think the stress of, patient management early on as well, when you're not so confident or things can go wrong, it definitely can get to you. I definitely have felt significant stress from dentistry, and I'm someone who, I've come across confident and all the rest of it, but it definitely affects us all. It's such an important thing. And I'd completely agree with asking other dentists and reaching out and all that. Obviously, I've asked you things over the years, and now I'm asking you for 2 hours of your time for a podcast. So I very much appreciate that. But I've had that response from most people. I haven't spammed everyone, but I have asked a few questions over my time, and it's worth it. And people are asking questions, if they want to ask me, like come out and ask me, and I'm sure you still feel the same. So absolutely. So if people want to get in touch, can they can just message you, things like that?
Just Facebook Messenger is good. If you've never messaged me before and I don't respond, then it's probably because I've just not seen the message. It goes to a different part of Messenger. But nowadays, I think they've fixed that issue. So I should be able to see most messages. Yeah, that's a great way. I've got my email on my website, the Practice Ownership website. That's a good way to get in touch as well.
Yeah, practiceownership.com.au. And just people probably interested in your group. What's your group called? Your practice, dental practice.
Oh, so all our practices are named differently depending on the suburb. Sure. Yeah. So we, my biggest practice is Raceview Dental. We've got practices, all over the place there. And they've all got different names, no group name.
Yeah, fair enough. Makes a lot of sense. Well, no, thank you so much for your time. We really do appreciate it. And all the best with the poker. I'll be keeping track of how you're going.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for your time, David. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That was a really great conversation. Thanks, Nov, for sharing so much with us. If you want to get in touch with Nov, you can get him on Facebook or on practiceownership.com.au. I hope you got a lot from this. If you appreciated it, I'd appreciate it if you could share this with a friend or a group of colleagues that you know that might benefit from this content. This week at dentalheadstart.com, I wrote a blog about a saddle matrix. I actually learned about this from Dr. Sahil Soni. This little matrix has been such a big help. If you're restoring the distal of a tooth that doesn't have a tooth behind it, it's so quick to place and so easy with a nice smooth curve. It's just a great little tool. So check that out at dentalheadstart.com. I hope it helps. For now, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.